Ah, fuck it. Let's just go into it. Ready? Okay, let's roll the intro. I don't want a pickle. I just want to ride on my motorcycle. All right, guys and gals, we're rolling with Noco Moto episode 22, I think, right?
Yep.
Yes, I got it right. All right, so I am your host, Moto G Pete. With me is Swiggy.
Yep.
And we've got a returning guest here. We've got Mr. Matty, the crazy man we met down at Coda.
We're going to use crazy as a loose term.
There we go. All right. Here, you can pull your mic just a little closer to you there. There we go. Okay. So let's talk bikes.
Sure.
That's why we're here.
Exactly.
Okay. So to start off here, we normally go straight into best worst bike, but I want to talk about the new Honda releases, right? Mm-hmm. So Moto Domus, I predicted in one of our games of Honda bringing back the monkey bike, and then they did, okay? And then, interestingly now, and even more exciting for me personally, they've brought back the Super Cub, which was always known as the Honda Passport here, or the C90, right? So they're both based off of the Grom. We've got... So they're both exactly the same motor, making exactly the same power, exactly the same torque, from what I can tell. That they haven't redone the engine in any way, or even the gears that I can tell.
I think you're getting a little less horsepower out of the Super Cub, and that's just because it's got the centrifugal clutch on it.
Would that really rob it of power, though?
Well, considering that the Grom makes 8.9 horsepower, it doesn't rob a lot,
right?
But it makes a difference.
Well, still, this is going to be the fastest Super Cub ever. Right? Yeah. You should bring one up on the screen here.
You said that like it was a Ferrari.
Right.
Yeah. The fastest one ever.
Well,
top speed, 35 miles an hour.
Well, we did an episode. It was probably, 10, 12 episodes ago. I just went on about the Honda Super Cub. It was my choice for best bike in the world that week. And I got into the whole history of it and how it's, not just the best-selling motorcycle, the best-selling vehicle in the world, right?
Because probably 10 million of those are sold in India, I would imagine.
Yes. Yeah.
All of Southeast Asia.
Yeah, all of them, yeah.
Well, a lot of them aren't actually made by Honda. They're all licensed from Chinese companies these
right.
days.
Right, because it sells so crazy well that Honda can't even make enough of them, right?
So they've subcontracted them out to...
Right. But this is the first time it's actually had a complete redesign since its inception in 1955. It did go from a spring sort of front end to telescopic forks in 1980. And other than that, it is pretty much unchanged. So now it's got a whole different motor, a whole different everything. And it's really spiritually close to the old one.
Yeah, so they updated the you've got the centrifugal clutch on it with a 4-gear 125 cc motor. It's got 2 disc brakes now,
which is cool.
Comes with ABS. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I think is actually genius is it's keyless start.
Yeah, that is such a weird feature to have on a budget machine like this.
But it's genius, and here's the reason why.
Can't leave your keys in it, and if you're parking it next to 5 million other ones, right?
Well, there's that, but also...
Yeah, that's a good point.
Harder steel, right?
The other thing is that, bikes like Groms get stolen all the time because you can just pick them up and put them in a wheelbarrow and run off with them if you want to. But if you've got keyless ignition and you're just making a shit ton of these things, it's enough of a pain in the ass to swap out the whole ignition system that for a cheap enough bike, it's going to make them a lot harder to steal.
It's like the concept of locking your front door, right? Anybody can just go up and kick your front door in if your door is locked. But the first thing a thief does, obviously, I don't know, I'm not a thief, but I would assume, would be to check to see if the door's unlocked, right?
Yeah.
So locking it is enough of a deterrent to just go, we'll go to the easier one, right? So if you got a transponder key in that or something, that's actually a really good idea. And that's actually a really sharp bike, too. And I'm really not a fan of the little CC'd... motorcycles. I think at that point you just get a scooter, but the
This is only one notch above. Yeah, this is only one notch above a scooter.
Yeah.
You don't even have a clutch lever. It's centrifugal.
It's just the fact that your legs go around. Otherwise, it pretty much could be a, you know, a people mover or a Metropolitan or something.
Right.
Now, I credited this with... this is going to sound crazy to you, Maddie, but I credited this motorcycle and Honda with creating essentially the entire American motorcycle culture as we know it today, which sounds really bold.
This bike. Okay.
So here's the reasoning. In 1955, when they put this thing out, they were like, okay, we need to start expanding into other markets, right? And they opened up shop in California, and it was just like a little shop, right? And up to that point, having a motorcycle was not a thing that normal people did.
Right.
There was no such thing as your neighbor having a Harley.
No, motorcycles were for rebels back then.
And exactly.
You were in a biker gang, right? In the 50s, if you had a motorcycle, you weren't some type of upstanding, you know, citizen or whatever. But I can see, you know, I can see beachgoers on these things, right?
Flip-flops. And that is exactly what happened.
Roll to the beach, right? That's a beach cruiser right there if I ever saw one. Or that's a motorcycle that you find in India with 12 people stacked on that thing, you know, going to wherever they're going, right?
This is also the first motorcycle that brought warranty and support and helped build proper dealership networks like we know them today. And Honda and its whole you meet the nicest people on a Honda thing all came from this. And so people bought Hondas and it became acceptable for regular people to ride motorcycles. And then, you know, Harley took off and, you know, people started buying more expensive and other crazy things after that. But this thing broke the doors open on that.
And I can see it being easily serviceable, obviously, from how simple it is, right? Most other bikes back in the 50s, when this would have been around, you know, would have been more custom bikes, right? Harder to find parts. You fabricate your own parts, you know?
Yeah, and it was all crazy British stuff or Harleys, and it was just impossible to get parts when you wanted them. It was like owning an Indian Royal Enfield in the States now. It was just...
right.
Yeah, the parts will arrive sometime between 3 weeks and when the earth falls into the sun, you're just screwed.
As much as I like to argue with people, I totally see all of that in this bike.
Right. Now, here's the problem. If you can bring up the monkey bike, no one's going to buy this thing now. No one's going to buy it.
No, because they can get something that looks the exact same for half the price because they're going to buy something used off of Joe Blow, and they're not going to spend whatever that is brand new. And I imagine, what is that, three grand? How much are they?
I think it's about $400 more than the Grom.
But what's the total sticker price on that thing? Because I wouldn't pay more
$3,800.
Yeah, and I wouldn't pay more than $2,500 for that bike. If that. Like, I wouldn't even pay that brand new, but I can see that as a reasonable cost for that bike for what somebody here in the United States anyway is going to do with that bike. Because at that point, I'm going to go buy a $1,000 scooter.
Yeah, I agree. Right.
Well, that's what I would do as well.
But this is what people are going to buy instead. It's a couple $100 cheaper. It looks a little more motorcycle-y.
Right.
And yeah, it's a Grom. You can do all the wheelies and hoon around on it. And, you know, this is going to be a little bit more trail oriented. This is the little fun thing that people are going
to
buy.
See, we like to call those pit bikes. So
right.
That's the perfect pit bike.
Oh, yeah. You're going to start seeing these just all around pits like crazy. Like, no more is Valentino Rossi, after he crashes, going to get hauled back on a Honda Metropolitan. It's going to be on the back of one of these.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but still, it's $400 less. So now we're saying that this thing is $3,400.
So this is $200 more expensive than the Grom. So this one's $3,800. The Metropolitan is $4,000.
You mean the Super Cub?
The Super Cub is $4,000. And it's like $4,200 with ABS. Now, I mean, if you bought that like secondhand with 1,000 miles on it, it's going to be like $3,000.
See, and these are fun as pit bikes, but I'm still going to buy something used for a couple $100, $1,000, $2,000, whatever, if I want something that's going to do what those things look like they're going to do. And if I want to take something on the street, I'm still going to buy a cheaper scooter. And, you know, so once again, I think my only argument with these things that's going to make them completely useless, even as much fun as they will be, I'm sure they're fun. You know, all bikes are fun, but is price point. Right. Yeah. Like I can go buy a used Super Street, right? Like a 600 for the cost of that thing. And I can buy one that's very well taken care of for that cost as well.
Right. So what we're looking at is a market of buyers that want something very small and unintimidating.
And it's a very small market.
And it's a very small market. And the thing is that the Grom is getting a little bit of a reputation as this hooligan sort of thing and whatever, which is kind of what it wants to have. No problems.
Grom is like a yuppie hooligan thing, right? Like right. You're a rebellious yuppie in downtown Denver, and so you ride a Grom or a ruckus, right? Ruckuses are kind of the same mm-hmm. along lines. And then, you know, like if you're a true yuppie in Denver, you have a Metropolitan. You have a People Mover. That's what you have.
Yeah. I love the Metropolitan.
And they're pretty. But
I would have the Super Cub over a Metropolitan. It's a little bit faster. It does a little bit more. It's more capable in traffic. And it is designed to be a People Mover even more than the Metropolitan.
Right.
But this thing is what people are going to go for because of all the options. This one looks the coolest. It comes right in the middle of the price. It's probably just as capable or the most capable in terms of riding on road and off road and all that sort of stuff. But this one, and Emma from Motorcycles and Misfits brought up this great point. There's enough old guys around right now that remember when the monkey bike was being sold originally, or they just remember at least a lot of them hanging around people's garages and things. And so there's a certain nostalgia for this one. The nostalgia factor for the Super Cub has died. Yeah. Because if you're going back to someone that remembers the motorcycling scene in 1955, 1960, that's a long time. Those dudes are like 90 years old now.
Yeah, those people are gone. And that scene was an alternate to what the real scene was.
Right.
Like the scene of those people with the Super Cups are, you know, those were beachgoers. Those were people that were, you know, relaxing. And, you know, this is like a subculture, right?
Right. Yeah. The real bikers at the time were listening to Elvis Presley, and the people who were riding the Super Cub were listening to the Beach Boys.
Yeah, exactly. And that's my point. So there's no nostalgia left in that bike. This I can see though, because we were talking earlier that, you know, you were talking about the monkey bike, and I was like, well, what do you call it? Something different or what? Like, is this something that I know of? So I've seen these bikes, and I was just talking with you guys. My neighbor actually had one, and the bike was super fun.
Yeah.
Super fun to get on. You go cruise around your neighborhood. The only purpose that I see for that trail bike is you don't have like a toy hauler or a motorcycle carrier, and you can fit one of these in your camper. You can fit one in the bed of your truck and go tent camping with it, and you can cruise it around the mountains. Mm-hmm. So I see that draw to it. And then the only other draw that I see to it is for, you know, you have kids that are into motorcycles, and you put them on one of those as opposed to, you know, putting them on like a true motocross dirt bike. You know, if you just have kids that are interested in motorcycles and they don't want to go to the racetrack and learn how to jump, they just want something fun to ride around on, right?
Yeah, rather than like a super tall 125 motocross bike or even like a junior 70cc.
Yeah, a family that's going to spend a small fortune on getting their kid into motocross. And there's a lot of those, you know, parents and families that do that, but there are also a lot of families like my family. Like when I was a kid, you know, our first bike was, my parents bought us a big bike. They were insane, but we lived out in the country on dirt roads, and we didn't care about jumping a bike and racing a bike. We just wanted something that we could get a thrill on, and so we had a little bike like that. So I started out on dirt with something similar,
kind of like a farm bike.
Yeah, pretty much. It was an enduro, right?
Yeah, just like not plated, just ride around.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Like it had blinkers and it could be functional and you could plate it. But, you know, when I was growing up, first of all, it was a long time ago. So, you know, the police didn't stop you for not having license plates, right?
Right.
So you could get on one of these little dirt bikes and you could go, you know, rip it around the neighborhood on all dirt roads and nobody bothered you, right? They would, if you were doing something really wild, you know, and a cop passed by, he might pull you over and tell you to go home, right? He goes, take your bike, go home.
Go, yeah. So I've theorized one way in which the Super Cub might find its audience in the States. And as you rightly pointed out, it's to do with price. It could completely just destroy all scooter and Vespa sales if, with this redesign, they use that redesign in all of them that they sell all over Southeast Asia and bring in the economy of scale. allowing them to bring the price down. Like you just said, if it costs $2,500, I mean, you couldn't stop people from getting it.
Oh yeah. And if you're somebody that lives in a nice, you know, compact downtown area, right? A lot of those people, not all of them, but a lot of those people, you know, have a considerable amount of spending money, mm-hmm. you know, to buy things like that and scooters like that to go to their, you know, local bar or whatever.
Or right? commute to work yeah. or right? whatever they're doing.
You could park those things in the bike rack.
There is one aspect of this that they're going to have to sell an absolute shit ton of them.
Yeah.
Because especially in the States. Well,
fortunately, it's the best-selling bike in the world. Well, if there is a bike that can actually come down and make economies of scale work for it, it's the Super Cub.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. In the U.S., if you want to mass-produce a motorcycle and sell it here, there is a fixed cost of $250,000 per bike, per model per year, just for emissions testing.
Right.
So there's this massive floor that sits on every bike, plus what all the other things you have to do, and then going through the dealer network, which is why, you know, the cheapest bike you can find right now is a Metropolitan at like $2,600, and it's got drum brakes and dual rear shocks and all of that, because there's only so cheap you can make it, just because just the regulatory pricing that goes into each model.
But you just said it right there, right? You just said a Metropolitan's $2,600, and I see very little difference picture wise looking at that Super Cub and thinking mm-hmm. about a Metropolitan, why they shouldn't be able to make those the price range very, very similar. Because I think if they focused on dropping that price, which part of getting that price lowered would just be reducing their profit on it, right? I mean, if your profit margin goes down, right? Like, it's like anything that you know, it's like going to Home Depot. You can buy material cheaper because Home Depot buys a bazillion of them, right? You know, so they're going to have to do that thing. And I think that's the only way that bike takes off here in the States. I think Asia, it will sell well. And I don't even think that it will sell as well as Honda is going to hope that it's going to sell, even in Asia, because they've kind of shot themselves in the foot with those bikes being so reliable that they're still everywhere, right? So who's going to go and go, I'm going to replace it with a new Super Cub and pay this money when I have this one that's been running for 20 years and once a year I rebuild the carb on it, or I...
20 years. Try 40, 50
well,
years.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm minimizing this whole situation, but you have a very, very reliable vehicle, right?
Right.
And so your decision to get rid of that vehicle to get a new one, especially in like the Asian market, is going to be...
Well, the reason the Asian market's so strong for it is none of them have cars.
Well, yeah, and it's population and it's density.
And it's a huge population, right? So they can move a lot of these things. And even if they are – because they have to be super reliable for them to buy them, because these are informed fucking buyers in Southeast Asia. A new bike comes out and they're like, oh, that looks pretty good. I'll wait till my neighbor has racked up 120,000 miles on this 50cc two-stroke to figure out if I think it's any good or not.
Right.
So I think that they will be able to sell a lot of them. It's just that those markets, those economies need to grow up a little bit, because, you know, the price on a Super Cub in those markets is ridiculous, like $800 or $900. Because, you know, that's what they can afford. And they've been making the same thing since 1955, right? It's like when they were still making Beetles in Mexico, right? It's the same thing. But if they can get the whole market to sort of just take that one little extra step up, right? If the quality of living, if the average income in those areas continues to improve slowly as it has, they might be breaking into just a next level of vehicle where they can have fuel injection or an ABS option or whatever. It's still, you know, a very cheap, small motorcycle that fits all their needs. And it will be a bit of a premium product over there. But I mean, like a Bullet 500 EFI is like the premium top of the heap thing to have in India, right? That's a $4,500 bike, right? Or is it $5,500 here?
It's like $5,200 here.
Right. So that's a probably, I don't know what it would work out into in cost in India, but probably
like $2,000-$3,000.
Right.
It's in that range.
So it's not crazy to think that, you know, a 9-horsepower Super Cub is something that would become a very desirable status symbol in those markets, and they'd be able to sell a lot of them.
Yeah.
We'll see if it happens, but I think we're all in agreement that until that happens, no one here is going to touch the Super Cub.
I think you're absolutely right. I think if anyone's going to purchase those right now in its price range, it's going to be purely for status symbol, right? Like, I'm going to roll that thing up against, you know, Metropolitan, and, you know, I'm just going to feel better about myself, right? Because I have this weird, funky part of the past, right? Like, so
I'm
cool.
Gonna impress everyone, right? Yeah, like this year's distinguished gentleman's ride.
Exactly. And if I had that kind of money to throw around and I had that kind of eccentric mentality, I would be someone with money and I would be able to pay for it at that price point. So I think those are the only times that I think that for right now, that's the only sales that you know, either of these two bikes are going to do. They're going to be for very small markets. That's going to be for racers, little pit bike. That's going to be for, you know, little kids who live on dirt roads way out in, you know, BFE. And then the other one is just going to be for a pure sense of social status and take it to your local bar and just kind of be able to snub people with the Metropolitans a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, but I would like to see the prices come down. I think they'd be a great bike. And it, you know, like I said, if either of those bikes were in the $2,000 range, you know, even a little bit higher,
You also have to keep in mind, if you're buying it new, you can add, you know, 30% on the price just for like a 1 or 2 year warranty. You're getting that value out of it. So if you were to subtract, you know, the value of the warranty, you're looking at buying something that you were solely responsible for with 0 miles on it for like, you know, $3,000. So I feel like it doesn't have to come down too much. If it was like $3,200 or $3,100,
yeah, I'd still be hard pressed for it, but it'd be more tempting. I would say that it would be more tempting, but I don't think I would touch it until it got into the twos.
Considering that they'll all hit 50 miles an hour, you know, and 45 very comfortably, if you're the sort of person that's looking to buy your first motorized thing with two wheels ever, it's not completely outrageous.
Super Cub would be a really good option for that,
right?
But not that, not the monkey bike. The monkey bike would not be a good, this is your first bike thing that you're actually planning on taking on a street. Like, I
thought that about the Grom too, and the Grom has been a gateway drug for people.
Yeah, the Grom has been great, but the Grom has been also like a rebellious, you know, social status kind of thing, right? And once again, compact cities, right? You live in the middle of downtown or whatever, and you want to be kind of a rebel, and you cruise a Grom, right? And you learn how to do stupid things on a Grom, right? Like, how many Groms were there at COTA? You know, people going around doing wheelies, just goofing off because it was a cheap thing, right?
Yeah.
It was brand new, and it had enough horsepower to just kind of, you know, wheelie it down the street or, right? And they really didn't care if they threw it into the dirt because it's a Grom. You just pick it back up, right? And just go.
I do remember the first year we went down to COTA. Somebody had a Grom in full KTM Red Bull livery.
Yeah, that was so wonderful.
They're similar looking too, right? They look like a little miniaturized Super Duke, right?
They do.
They're kind of crazy.
All right. Well, I think we've covered this. I think this is the definitive word on Honda's new 125 lineup.
I think we all agree on the major points, and you know.
All right. Now it's time for best worst bike in the world. So you've got worst bike in the world this week, right, Swiggy?
I do.
All right. So reveal the worst bike in the world.
The worst bike in the world is the Honda Grom.
Are you shitting me?
Oh, we did not see this coming.
No. Well, yeah, just remind the listeners, we never know. Yeah. Like, these are always a surprise for everyone.
Hold on. Let me jump in my Wayback Machine and take away everything I said about the Grom. Oh, wait, unless your points aren't valid. Go ahead.
Okay, right. Well, here's the problem with the Grom.
Okay.
Overall, you know, kind of pretty good value for money. It's got a lot of features. You got the ABS. you know, it's got some decent horsepower.
Well, at 9, I don't know if it's decent.
Well, no, it's good for... It has
just enough
per scale
horsepower.
For scale, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, for scale, it's good. But the problem is, it doesn't make sense anymore when you've got the monkey bike and the Super Cup.
But wait a second, how much is the Grom?
It's $200 cheaper than the monkey bike.
See, so I'm still... I feel like a racer on a Grom, right?
That's, right.
That's what those people feel like on Groms, right? Look, it comes with street tires, for crying out loud.
Well, I wonder if that's what Sweetie's getting at. When it's only $200 more for the monkey bike's a much more capable and actually sort of purpose-built trail bike that's still going to be good as a city commuter.
There's that.
I would agree
with that. But now, you know, when the Grom came out, there wasn't really anything like it at the time. There wasn't this kind of miniaturized, like scaled down... 125 that was right. Very approachable with a low seat height, you know, good for first time riders, you know, good for women who don't have a very large,
very true. Anything in that CC range was typically a cruiser bike, right?
Right. But then you got the Z125 copying it. Okay. It was a hot ticket item when they were constantly selling out and you couldn't find one and they were showing up on eBay for more than MSRP.
They were like Tickle Me Elmo during Christmas, right?
That's right.
Right.
Tickle
Me. But now you have these other options that have the nostalgia value.
Okay.
The same motor.
Okay.
Yep. Superior features.
Or we're gonna, is that subjective or is that true?
Well, in terms of, you've got the monkey bike, which is a little bit lighter.
Okay.
With a similar feature.
The monkey bike is lighter?
Yeah.
Wow, that thing looks like a heavy pig, too. I just know how much fun they are.
Well, it's like 4 pounds lighter.
Yeah, but 4 pounds with 8 horsepower, that's a lot of weight, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's also, you know, lunch and a beer.
Yeah.
Exactly, right? So you could ride on an empty stomach, or you could ride on a full stomach and be just as fast.
Right. You know, you've got the Honda Pass or the Honda Super Cub,
right,
which has the centrifugal clutch. It's got the leg guards. It's the more classic. You know, they're both more classically styled, and
they're got a much longer range as well.
There's that too. So now you've got these two other bikes that have these different options. They don't have clones. You know, there isn't an equivalent to the Super Cub or to the monkey bike like the Z125. Is to the Grom. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we're just saying it's lost all of its individuality and its pizzazz, right? The pizzazz has been done and we're all over it now. Is that
right?
Is that why it's the worst?
Yeah. Okay. The Grom is like people who are still dabbing today. I got to get with the times.
Nailed it.
Oh, God, that's great.
10 points.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, it's still trying to do kind of the whole modern angular thing, which in a lot of ways works.
But it really hasn't changed its look since its inception, right? Because in its inception, it was so radical looking, right? And they really haven't done a whole lot to it.
Right. And, you know, this has kind of been done to a degree with a lot of the adventure bikes as well. And, you know, it's a lot of the angular stuff that a lot of dirt bikes are doing. But it's a brave new world now. And the rules don't really apply.
And the Grom's not brave anymore.
I mean, you know, we live in a world where Dennis Rodman is bringing peace to the Korean Peninsula. You know, just throw out everything you know.
Well, didn't Trump just shake hands with Kim Jong-un?
Right.
Who do you think set it up?
Jesus, who knows, man? I'm not even...
No, Dennis Rodman set it up.
Are you serious?
Wow. Yeah.
I'm out of touch. I just like motorcycles.
Right.
They're my friends, not people.
I just want to say really quick, I don't know if I've said this before, but I have been in love with Dennis Rodman and Kim Jong-un's love affair for so long. Like, I don't know if I said this on another episode, but I think this has really happened where, because Kim Jong-un's obsessed with making movies, right?
Well, Dennis Rodman's one of the only people who's ever actually been in North Korea without a huge, like to do, or ever really, I think.
Right. And I think somewhere
he brought a bunch of Harlem Globetrotters. He brought a bunch of Harlem Globetrotters.
I mean, there have been some isolated incidences, but I do know in the past that Dennis Rodman has pretty much got a free pass into that place, you know, like anytime he wants. And I've always thought that was a little odd, but I haven't.
And like Kim Jong-un gets like these like film directors and like holds them hostage until they like direct movies that he stars in and stuff. Right. I think there's a Kim Jong-un, Dennis Rodman, buddy cop movie that exists. That none of us will see until like the whole regime is done with.
Is this like a Rush Hour, right? Like a rush hour exactly. With Dennis Rodman and Kim Jong-un.
Oh, you know it exists.
It's in his equivalent of the Prince Vault.
Right. Well, and it's great too because
it'll come out like 30 years from now.
Oh my God.
I think both of them overestimate the relationship, right? So like Dennis Rodman is like, man, I'm like FBI, NSA, like levels of importance, right? And Kim Jong-un, you know, isn't really in touch with the rest of the
world. Maybe he thinks that he's that way in celebrity status. Like Dennis Rodman thinks that way he's in government status. And so Kim Jong-un thinks he's that way in celebrity status because he knows Dennis Rodman.
Exactly. He's like,
they have these two crazy alternate realities that have nothing to do with their real personalities going on. And it just excites them both. Is that?
Yeah. He's like, I have important American celebrity on the inside. Like, oh my God. You know?
Oh my God.
Yeah. He has no idea that Dennis Rodman is completely washed up.
Well, I think that since our conversation about the Grom turned into a conversation with Dennis Rodman and Kim Jong-un, that would officially mark the Grom as the worst bike ever, right? Because we've allowed ourselves to just like fall into this hole.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like the Grom thing is...
I get it. Like it's spent, right? And I've really never thought of it from that perspective, right? Because I always see him around. They just look like so much fun.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe we'll exist. It will move into this universe where the monkey bike and the super cub force the prices down on these. Because like 6 blocks from my house, someone's had one of these in their driveway trying to sell it for like $3,400 for weeks and can't get rid of the fucking thing.
Because they missed the window.
Exactly, well, they missed the window.
Maybe they'll just turn into, maybe the Grom, you know, in 10 or 15 years will become some type of weird nostalgic thing, right? Like,
yeah.
Like you'll roll up on a Grom and you'll roll up next to, you know, its competitors and its lookalikes, right? And you'll be able to snub somebody for it, right? You'll be like, I'm on a real Grom and you're on
If I could pick that. One up for $1,200, you couldn't stop me from buying one. But these things still, it doesn't matter. If it's the first year Grom and it's got 25,000 miles on it, it's still three grand.
Exactly. I'm always going to have a price point problem with these bikes. These bikes are super fun, and I've been on quite a few of these bikes now. I haven't actually ridden a Grom, but you know the monkey bike and the Super Cub. You know I've ridden different variations of these bikes. They're all super fun, but I would rather pay, you know, dirt cheap for an old one and go home and spend a couple days or a week or whatever rebuilding one and refurbishing one to my satisfaction to make it roadworthy, then go out and buy one of these things new. Cause it just, for me, it doesn't make sense. And I'm not a frugal person. Like I'm willing to spend some money, but just, I can't justify it. I can't do it. There's something in me that just won't let me do it.
Right. When for $3,000, you can go out and buy something like my 03 Super Hawk.
Right.
In great condition.
Or you could buy like three of those, you know, older in really great condition. You know, you could spend $1,000 a piece and you could have a whole fleet of scooters in your garage for the cost of one of those brand new.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
There we go. Honda Grom, you're officially no longer relevant. No Komodo's shot you down. Okay. Any other points to make on it? Or are we going to move on to best bike?
Let's move on.
All right. So now the best bike in the world this week, the 2005 to 2006 Kawasaki Ninja 636.
Or as I like to call it, the 2005-2006 Kawasaki Ninja ZX6RC1636 is its official. It's a mouthful.
It is.
For sure.
So back in the late 90s. It's the Green Machine, gonna rock the town without being seen. To really about like 2008-2009, it was all about sport bikes. And really, it was about super sports. This is when super sports became super sports. When you said super sport before that, you know, because like racing classes were all sort of chaotic until that time. with 1 liters and 750s and 600s and 500s and two-stroke racing. Like race class displacement was sort of all over the place. But then late 90s, it really comes together with essentially the 600 and 1 liter classes like we know them today. And yeah, there's been some changes in between, but it's more or less kind of stuck there.
And I also have to interject and say that before that time as well, a lot of what you would consider a super street bike or a super sport bike was simply just, it was no better than having a cruiser bike or like a Harley frame and chassis.
Right.
There wasn't a whole...
They weren't purpose-built bikes. They weren't track bikes that you could just happen to be able to buy.
They wanted to be that. And they tried to be that, but they would just take a cruiser bike and they'd modify some stuff. They go, yeah, this one, you know, and they still handled terribly, right? Mm-hmm. They turned into straight line racers for punks, really.
Exactly.
Until the 90s.
So you get, you know, things like the very first R6, which was amazing and blew everyone's mind. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was like my old ZX6 E-Ninja, the ZZRs, and all this stuff is all making like about 100 horsepower, a little bit more, and it was all great. And, you know, the speed wars are going on at this time, right? And yep. People think about the speed wars and they think about the Busa and the Super Blackbird and the ZX1100 and all that sort of stuff.
But it was going on a smaller level. But it was
going on in all the classes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Kawasaki had the Ninja name, you know, and that always sold a lot of bikes. But then Kawasaki did something really interesting. And one of the things we've discussed on the show that we love before is that Kawasaki and Suzuki in particular are always willing to escalate.
Which is what I love about Kawasaki.
And Kawasaki escalated in the strangest way. They went, all right, we're going to break the 600 class and make it not real. You know, they still made a very small run of like 500 ZX6 RRs, which were the 599 CCs. But they were like, for the main production bike of the ZX6R this year, we're making the 636. And never before has 37 CCs had such a fucking impact.
Go Ninja, go Ninja, go. Go Ninja, go Ninja, go. Go Ninja, go Ninja.
Because Kawasaki just whips its dick out and slaps Yamaha and Suzuki and Honda across the face. And everybody wanted a 600 Super Sport anyway. And then this became the fucking one to have.
And you couldn't even find these things. These things were sold out before they were rolled into stores. Just,
oh, yeah.
Just based on word of mouth, right? Like, it's that nasty rumor that goes behind everybody's back, right? That, you know, that your mom's good in the sack, right? And everybody wants a piece of your mom. They're lining up at the door, right? Well, your mom spent before you get some. So, you know, now you got to go home and be sad. You got to go buy a 600. You got to go buy an R6. You got to, right?
Right. And it was such an embarrassment to the other companies, right? Because they couldn't bring themselves to actually break the 600 class. So they had to do all these patently dishonest things. Because this was the highest revving 600 as well at the time. Was something like, what is it, Manny? Like 15,000, 16?
It's 15,500 RPM.
Which is crazy. But
at then, 14 to 1 compression.
But in like 2000, yeah. So this was 05, 06.
Yeah, because they bumped up compression on it too.
In like 07, 08, Yamaha comes back with the R6 to answer, and they're like, this motorcycle revs to 17,000 RPM.
But the top four of that is just fall on your face.
Well, that's... Yes, true, but also it didn't actually rev to 17,000. Yamaha just straight up lied and in fact was forced to publicly announce that it was not true. It was more than 1,000 cc, more than 1,000 RPM, like 15 less and a than half. It was, well, the Ninja, right? But Kawasaki was trying to do all these things to claim it was more powerful and better than it was, because the new bar was the 636. But Yamaha and Suzuki and everyone was still only going to go to that 599 limit, right? And no one else had the balls to go where Kawasaki did, because Kawasaki realized it's just a fucking street bike.
Yeah.
Like, for homologation purposes, we'll make the RR, but for the one that we're actually going to sell to everyone, we're just going to fucking escalate, and we dare you to fucking go where we're going.
And Kawasaki has always been like that, too. That's why they have so many different variations of CC'd motors. I mean, oh, yeah. Even before the Super Street era, right? I mean, you got ZX you know, 11s and 9s and 7s, right? Just
we and at this time, and on, too, right? They were making a ZX12R as well.
Yeah. Yep.
For no other reason than it was just like more CCs were going to escalate, mm-hmm. right? And also, the, you know, if you look at like Kawasaki's cruiser line today, right? There's a 2-liter Vulcan. Why? Because Kawasaki's willing to fucking escalate.
Well, no fucking.
Don't also, get in a fight with Kawasaki because they will go there real fast.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is that, like, you know, it's Kawasaki Heavy Industries. They're used to making like 4,000, like 4-liter cylinders.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's kind of their bread and butter.
It's stamped on the bike, Kawasaki Heavy Industries.
It is. Yeah.
So Heavy Industries is like what made the 636, which makes it all the more, you know, just like, I dare you, right? Like, you walk up and read a tag about Heavy Industries. Well, that's heavy. Like, Jesus. Like, what does that thing do, right?
And not you only let that, it
loose on the street.
I want to talk about the styling too, because this is the styling that defines the ninja look to this day. You know, if you go back to the old like GPZ 900, whatever, that's a great classic look and it was way ahead of its time. But when you ask anyone to just sort of close their eyes and imagine a ninja, this is the one that pops up.
Yep. Or the ZX10 because
and this was identical. Only run for 2 years, right? The model that came before this looked actually a little bit more modern. It was more angular. They actually just kind of rounded it out and changed it for this one. Yeah. And just, I think it's absolutely beautiful.
The 04 had the 04 636 had kind of a snub nose. It had different telemetry. So 05, 06 was the first time for the 600 platform that Cowie just took their plans and their piece of paper and just crumpled it up and threw it in the trash. I'm like, nah, fuck this. We're starting completely over.
Because they went to 636 right when they did the fuel injection, right?
So the first year of the injected 636, I
02?
I want to say it was 02 because they did the run 02, 03, 04. And then they threw the whole thing away and then they came up with this beautiful design and styling. And like you said, this design.
But this one sheds weight. This one also increases RPM and power. Like, this is the one to have.
This is the birth of the current 600 platform, 636 platform in Kawasaki.
Right.
And I don't know why they did away with it after 06, but it makes it that much more of a special bike because, I mean, look at it. It was the first time that they had gotten away with they still had floppy blinkers, but they anticipated you doing flush mounts. And so those triangles right there, mm-hmm. that is not the factory blinker on the front on this picture because the factory blinker is still a stupid floppy one, but it's a whole piece that's just two screws that comes out. And right when that bike hit the street, you know, like they do with most, they already had those aftermarket replacement parts, the integrated taillight, the integrated front blinkers. This was the first year of the undertail exhaust. So you mm-hmm. get maximum, you don't get any pipe interference if you're leaning this thing over and it will lean. And then suspension telemetry change, swing arm change, bigger brakes, you know, the ram air. I don't know if they did 8 injectors on the 04. I'm not sure. I'd have to even look at that, but this has 8 injectors.
Is this dual stage fuel injection?
Yeah. So it's 4 direct port.
I got the stats up. They at least have it on the 2005 and later. They have twin injection.
They're identical.
Yeah, we're talking about the 05, 06 here specifically. Yeah.
It has twin injection.
And they're identical bikes. They changed nothing from 05 to 06. They released it twice and then they went, we're done, have fun, collect it.
Basically. Yeah. But, you know, there's a lot of other things about this that are really impressive too, like the 4.5-gallon fuel tank.
Yep.
Really nice. You know, the power again was amazing because it went from making something like 105 horsepower, 110 horsepower at the rear wheel to making like 120 at the rear wheel, something like that, very close.
So,
and like 130 at the crank. Is that right, Maddie?
So, here we'll open up the box. I have this bike.
Yes. Maddie owns this bike.
This is my favorite bike. I have the 06. I have the Kawasaki color, the lime green, and I've owned this bike since it very first came out in 2005. So, and I've owned two of these. I've owned the 05 and I've owned the 06. And the one that I ride now is the 06. But we had a where was I going with this? Oh my God. What were you just asking me about the,
I don't know.
So we had fuel tank,
like 130 horsepower.
Oh yeah. Crank. Yeah. Yeah. So it's 130. So a regular 600, the ZX6 RR. So in 2004, the R was the 600 and the RR was the 636. And then, in 05 and 06, they flip flopped it. And if you had a ZX6 R, you had the 636 and the RR was the 600. And then in 07, they flipped it back because they completely got rid of the 636. But yeah, they're 130 brake horsepower right out of the box. And a normal 600 is 110 brake horsepower out of the box. And I believe to the rear tire, a 600 would pull 90 something horsepower. And the 636 would pull, it would actually pull around 118 or so, somewhere around there.
Yeah, it was only 120. I said about close to 120. So
mine out of the box with a jumper mod and a K&N air filter, some minimal things, mine dynoed at 122 to the rear tire with very, very little mods.
Yeah.
And I took it to a bike night one time and just strapped it to the dyno because I had no idea. I was like, well, I wonder, go ahead, right? And so they ripped one off and it was 122. It was like 121.8 or something ridiculous.
Yeah.
It was 10 years ago that they did this. But yeah, so they produce a shit ton of power.
They do. And yeah, noticeably more. And like I said, it's never before has 37 cc's made such a difference. Because when you think about what horsepower they're getting per cc, and then the increase in power from that 37, it doesn't make any sense. It's like, what kind of super cc's are we adding to this, right? But it's because they did a whole engine redesign and everything, yep, as well at a very strategic time. And the, you know, and why is it 636? You know, because they went, okay, we're breaking the 600. So rather than just going up to this limit, we can make the bore and stroke in this exact dimension that we want for maximum efficiency of power, rather than just going with this bore and stroke that's the best we can do with this arbitrary 600 number.
Because they maintain the same block. It's the, yes, same block.
Right. But so again, the fuel injection system's different. The bore and stroke's different. The connecting rods are way different, I think. And I think it's they went to like counter-rotating on this as well, if, yep, I'm not mistaken.
Yep, it's counter-rotating. There's only one or two things that you could consider even a flaw on this bike. And I actually start to consider them more character. So like, for example, the cam button is hydraulic.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's mechanical, and then you can change it to a hydraulic button. So it constantly needs to be adjusted. So my bike, if I pull up to you, it will tick. It has this very distinctive sound. It's not broken, and it doesn't sound like a Ducati clutch or anything. It's very, right, it's not very noticeable, but you ride up and you can hear the cam button in there. Right. And no, yeah, bikes do that. Right. And I've had people go, what is that tick? And I go, it's Kawasaki.
Right.
Like, bring it, right?
Yeah, it's like, when people listen to come my, get some. I'll show you my Super Hawk, and they're like, why does it sound so weird? I'm like, it's got gear-driven cams. That's just how it sounds. Yeah,
it's just like, this, it's just this very, right? Like, it has its own, it, the bike really has a character, right? It's one of those things that's very easy to ride, and it's very easy to adapt to, but it's probably, out of all the bikes I've ever been on, it is probably the one that as soon as you show it no respect, it will return the favor. Oh. Because it has the power and agility to do it.
I've crashed one of these. I know.
Like, it's prepared to kill you. Right.
I crashed one in 06 when they were brand new. A buddy of mine got one, and he got an 05, and he let me ride it a little bit later. And, well, first the thing scared the shit out of me because I'd never been on anything new.
It flies like a leader bike until about 120, 140 miles an hour.
Yeah. I was just going along in second gear, and I thought, let's crack it. And I'd never ridden a bike like this before in my life. And I cracked the throttle, and before I could really just like react to what the bike had done, I was doing 110 in second gear.
Yeah.
And I was, and again, and all I had ever ridden, the newest bike I had ridden to that point was my 81 Nighthawk 650.
Yeah.
Which, and I went straight to this, cracked the throttle. The thing just takes off. I'm on this farm road in the middle of nowhere in Indiana. I just know there's like, there's no turn off. There's no driveway. There's nothing right. for a mile. Here we go. We gone to the Brick. We had gone to the Jonesville Tavern in Southern Indiana, right? And I'm just rip it open, going down the road, and just it happened that fucking fast, and I couldn't react, and I didn't even like. I was just like, all I could do was just let go of the throttle, and just let the bike calm down.
And the compression is so high, the engine braking is amazing. So it's built to be, you know, it's an on street race bike.
I mean, right.
As pure, isn't this as like, pure as that could be.
Like 13 something compression? What is it? 13.9.
Yeah.
14.
14 to 1, right?
Right. I mean, that's
insane.
This requires actual premium octane fuel.
Yes, it like, does.
Not even mid grade.
Yeah. I have to put 91 in it here up at a mile high, and there are a lot of bikes that can get away with 89, and I can't do that with it. And it brings up another character point, too, talking about the speed. And so this bike has a all digital display. So
yes, and that was the first one for Kawasaki.
Yes, it was. And so the RPM wraps around the mile per hour, the numeric miles per hour, and then the RPM wraps around it, right? And everything is digital. The RPM gauge is digital, the speedometer is digital, the count off is, everything is digital. It was also it also has a lap timer on it.
That was stock?
So yeah, that was stock. So there's awesome. So you can change your mode on the display to lap timer, and you can pound off a lap at the racetrack, and you can hit a lap button that is right next to your, I'd have to go down to my bike and look because I don't use it that often, but I believe it's on the clutch side, and it says lap on it, and you go click, and it'll click off different laps, so you can start it, and then you do a lap, and then you push the button, and it will record that lap time, and then keep the timer going, and then you go lap two, and you click it, and it will record that number, and then just right. keep going, right, and it'll dial off laps for you. But one of the best things about this bike that I found out when I got it, which was insane, was the first time, you know, I adjusted to this bike and I was like, okay, now you just, like, I could tear off on it anytime I want, right? Like, me and the bike, we're friends now, right? So I realized that if you go from a dead stop and you drop the clutch and grab a fistful and just drop the hammer on it, you can actually outrun the digital speedometer in first gear.
I've heard people talk about this.
So you cannot outrun the RPM gauge in any gear, but because the speedometer gives you a digital display, right? So it tells you 10 miles an hour. It doesn't have a needle, right, with indicators. It's an actual, you know, it counts, right, like a clock.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you punch it in first, the thing will just start rattling off numbers because it doesn't know how fast it's going. So it'll just go 10, 15, 46, blue, you know, 72, 63, blah, 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 and then you shift it. And then it jumps into second gear. And when it jumps into second gear, it catches up with itself. And then it tells you how fast you're going. So you can rip it off. It's the bike is 72 in first gear, which for a 600 is insane. I know that's not a lot for a liter bike. You know, liter bikes are usually in the 80s for their first shift point. But that bike, I can tell you, is out of the box, it's 72 in first, it's 117 in second, it's 136 in third, 154 in fourth, 168 in fifth, and then the fastest I've ever gotten that bike was 182 miles an hour stock.
Right. So the point is that this is a motorcycle from 2005, like more than 10 years ago, that is not only as good as any 600 you can buy today, but in many ways better. I mean, really. And the crazy thing is that the going rate for them, $3,000 to $4,000.
Yeah. I could buy that for the cost of the bikes that we were just talking about, for a Grom or a Super Cub or the Monkey Bike, I could have one of those used. And in fact, I purchased one probably for somebody else, but it was quite a few years ago. And I got that for $4,000 probably 6 or 7 years ago.
Right.
So in 2011, I found one with like 1,800 miles on it and got it for $4,000.
Yeah, I just brought up Denver Craigslist and like there's for 2005s and sixes, the highest one that I see right now is 3,800.
Yeah, because people don't know.
They don't know. Right. But you know what? They did know at the time. Like I said, of all the 600s were the shit at the time. And this was the king daddy of them all. And, you know, it's just – it's an absolute class leader, but it also breaks all the fucking rules. And, you know, like Gixxer 600s are the most stolen, the most crashed, the most wheelied, the most whatever now.
Right.
This was the bad reputation bike at the time, which is also really fucking cool. Right. And like I said, you know, Yamaha did a lot with the R6 to sort of make that the performance leader, but only by tiny, tiny margins.
Yeah.
And this thing
and
just
huge efforts too.
But you know, the R6 is very technical. It's very no compromise. This thing rides around just giving double middle fingers everywhere it goes, but it doesn't like it. It's effortlessly cool at the same time.
Yeah.
It has an X factor that other 600s don't have. I've said I love 600s, but they're largely kind of all the same. This one breaks the mold, is very, very different, has its own character, and that sets it apart as well. So of any kind of super sport bike you can think of, I don't think anything else comes close.
Yeah, it's a very primal bike. So you get on it and it will, you can fishtail that bike, you can wheel spin that bike, you can drag that bike as far over as you want to. You know, it's got the undertail exhaust. You know, they did a lot of stuff to that that was still coming into new technology back in the day. Like, for example, the butterfly valve on the undertail exhaust to mm-hmm. maximize torque off the line. And then also, you know, when you punch it, it'll give you a small flap shut. Right. And give you a bunch of torque buildup. And then you get an 8 injector spray. And then it just literally, it will just rip your head off. If you're in the right RPM range in any gear, it will just tear away on you. Right. So it's a very, very monstrous. It's like a monster, right? In your closet, right? As long as it's in the closet, it's fine. Right. But you know, when you turn the lights out and you go open up the doors, right. And you tell the monster it can come out. What does the monster do? The monster just fucks your room up. Right. And your mom comes in and goes, what the hell just happened in here? You go, nothing, mom. Right. And you just put it back in the closet. So, but as far as handling bikes, that's probably what that bike is probably the best handling bike I've ever been on. And I'm a very stick and move kind of rider, and me and my bike are very close. And so it understands, right. That's a bike that you can truly become one with, right. You're not riding a bike. You are the bike when you take that thing out.
Yeah. And, you know, you were talking about like its brutality. That's also because it has the most torque of anything in the 600 class at like 48 point something, almost 49 foot pounds of torque. That's, well, not a huge amount of torque in the grand scheme of things, a shit ton for a 600.
But it's also the way it delivers it as well, too.
Mm-hmm. So. This is 52.
52?
No, Jesus. But like 48 or something makes it to the back wheel.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, 52 at the crank is retarded high for a 600. Like, that's just, well, yeah, just doesn't exist. But it does in the 636. I mean, like, you know, the R6 makes like 41 at the rear wheel, something like that. So, right. You know, there's more than an entire Grom's difference in the torque between those two bikes.
Which is why you can drag race that against a leader bike. So I can't tell you how many times I've showed up at the line right at the light at 6th Avenue, right? Going eastbound out of Golden, right? And you just sit at that light and somebody will show up, right? You know? Right? Like you can call it like the Wild West with that bike, right? Just be sitting there and a guy will show up on a, you know, on a ZX10 or an R1 or whatever, and you just look over, right? And a lot of the times people would think that that's a leader bike because of its size. So the size is very deceiving on it because of the full fairing and just how it's captured. And if it wasn't for the number,
636,
the numeric on it, you wouldn't know what it was. And that Latigo Green, you can just drop the hammer and you can light up a leader bike. I have yet to be beat to 100 miles an hour by even a leader bike on that. So you'll drop it and you won't tell them what size your bike is, right? And they'll think you're on a leader bike and you'll be smashing. You know, you'll be looking at each other. Both of you are looking, right? Everybody's got a fistful of throttle, you know, and you're still looking over at each other. And then here comes 100 miles an hour and you're still just looking at each other, right? And then it'll go to about 120. And then depending on the leader bike, there are some that I could take side by side to 140. And then that's when the leader kicks in, right? They're like, there's only so much damage I can do, but it's the torque, it's how it's delivered, it's the butterfly valve, it's the undertail exhaust, it's the, you know, the way the bike is set up with this amazing, you know, low, mid, high range. Also the jumper mod that's available on that bike in that specific year. And so, I mean, it was a competitor's bike because, you know, you could straight line somebody to considerably high speed. And then not only that, but if you took them to the hills, that bike is 50 pounds lighter than anything else. And it corners, you know, better than, you're not fighting all that centripetal force, you know, that you're fighting on a leader bike with that extra weight. So it wants to turn, it wants to fall over and dip into corners and display agility. Like that's what that bike wants to do. That bike doesn't give a fuck about a straight line, even though it's pretty good in one. So,
yeah. It's overall, every aspect of it is just not just better than average, way better than average. So I'm declaring it the best bike in the world. And let's just take a quick break here and come back with another topic. All right, so we're back. Now, Maddie is probably... he rivals us, basically, in MotoGP fanaticism. So, we are going to do some silly season theorizing, catch-up, whatever you want to call it now. So, in the last episode, we talked about Lorenzo, the shocking decision of Repsol to pick up Lorenzo, which I'm a big fan of. Just to recap here, this is just going to allow Pedrosa to become Iannone levels of crazy. Repsol has the money to stroke his ego and just let him do whatever the hell, right? Because it was the shape of the gas tank is what he claimed was holding him up at Ducati. Ducati makes him a new gas tank, and then he goes faster. It doesn't make any sense except that it changed him mentally in that they just sort of pampered him a bit, and that helped him go faster. I can't come up with any logical reason why he finally found speed on the Ducati.
You know, it was really interesting, too, because like the two races previous, you know, he started basically doing what Zarco did at the beginning of last season, where he's like, oh, I'm going to go soft. And then I'm going to lead the race and I'm going to try and manage the lead. And, you know, going into the last race, I was actually kind of getting a little bit pissed where I was like, okay,
you're waiting for him to fall back.
Well, because the Ducatis have trouble passing each other because they're hard on the brakes early.
Yep.
And they take the much more aggressive line and power out of the turn. So it's really hard for one Ducati to pass another Ducati. It's like, okay, well, here Lorenzo's just going to be another rogue green turtle shell on Rainbow Road. Like,
just holding another 10 point swiggy.
Just holding everybody up.
Right.
And then, you know, the Repsol is kind of, it's got a good balance between braking hard and carrying a little bit of speed through the corner. So Marquez can get past him, and Marquez has been having a lot of success going for a slightly harder tire, and then he's just kind of managing that lead because he knows, if I can just keep up with you, I'm going to take you out in the second half of the race.
You know, in MotoGP, there's really two kinds of main bikes, right? And it's the difference between riding a bull and being on a train, right?
Yeah,
You're either on rails or you have this giant, powerful, psychotic thing that you figured out how to tame and ride for 8 seconds, right? And so there are two different riders and two different styles. And what I find really, really neat about Repsol is that through their evolution, probably in the last, 5 years, they found out to have this really weird happy medium between the bull and the rails, right?
Yeah.
And that's why Marquez is doing so well, because Marquez can ride the bull, and then he's also a very technical rider. So as much as I hate Marquez, I mean, he's a fantastic rider. I mean, I wouldn't call him a reincarnation of Rossi, but, you know, he is definitely an
elite. He's that level. His own.
Is that level, right? So that was Lorenzo's pitfall with going to Ducati, right? Because he went from riding the rails on a Yamaha, which is a very technical, bike, a very, you know, accurate bike, you know, to the bull, right?
Yeah. Well, here's one thing. As soon as Lorenzo won, my immediate thought was, Danny's getting fired.
Oh, mine was the race was rigged.
So the reason I say that is because, you know, Danny's job basically has been, okay, well, you're really just keeping the seat warm. As long as you can pull off a couple wins a season and regularly place top five, then if Marquez wins the championship, then you've secured the team championship, you've secured the manufacturer champ, the constructors championship.
Exactly.
We're happy.
They keep a strong rider in the wing so that they can make up those points for the team, right? So
yeah,
they
right.
win the constructors.
But as soon as you've got a 1-2 from Ducati, it's like, okay, we got to change it up now. Like, and that was just that. So,
well, they've been talking about it before the 1-2 from Ducati. There were some serious considerations about Pedrosa,
right?
Especially you know starting probably at the end of last season. You know, Pedrosa has been not seriously, but he has been tossing around the idea of doing a few things, either going down in class where he can kind of decrease his competition level, where his risk factor for injury, you know, gets a little bit lower,
right?
Or getting out of the sport.
I mean, yeah, because
he has
Pedrosa is like. Has basically been on track for, you know, Evel Knievel levels of punishment and
oh, yeah.
pain and agony in his retirement.
He's so small when a crash happens, right? Like, you high-side Pedrosa, he's going twice as far as anybody else.
He's broken his collarbone, like, six times now?
Well, yeah, and then what did he do on the last crash, on the last nasty high side?
I don't know if he fractured his wrist, but he seriously injured his wrist, which is not the first time.
Yeah, he hurt himself pretty good, and it was an ugly crash.
He also did right before COTA as well. So, now, here's the other thing, is somewhere that Ducati and Suzuki are significantly lagging behind Yamaha and Honda, not just in kind of the performance of the bikes, and in some ways I would say that Ducati is kind of edging out Yamaha right now, performance-wise.
In horsepower, yes, but I don't...
But they're up there.
They're starting to master their cornering right. game, but they've always had the Ducati tractor beam.
Right. But kind of where both teams are really lagging behind is everything off the track.
Well, yeah, their management is fucking haywire.
Right.
Right, like all of it. They're so scatterbrained, right, that they can't pull it together because they don't have a fucking Jarvis in the driver's seat, right?
The off track stuff with Ducati constantly entertains me. I've always talked about how Ducati is the most likely team to just be blatantly cheating at any given moment. Just the constant complaining and raising hell about can they have winglets? Can't they have winglets? What are they going to do?
They are the drama queens.
And you know they stoked that whole fire with the salad box controversy and everything. Right. They're just insane, and I love that.
Right.
But, I mean, look at what's happening to Suzuki and Ducati now. Lorenzo wins his first race. And now he's immediately moving to Honda. Iannone puts together an amazing, especially for Suzuki,
right?
You know, first half of the season.
Right.
And now he's going to Aprilia. And they're keeping Rins. Like, what's going on behind the scenes in the contract negotiations that this is happening?
Yeah, I want to talk about Rins and Aprilia here. Because the Aprilia is the worst bike on the track.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's worse than the KTM, and that's saying something.
Well, and you know that Tech 3 is going to KTM. They're not going to be...
Right.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and it is Yamaha... people keep talking
Zarco's
about...
Zarco's going to KTM.
Yeah, Zarco's going to KTM, which is super disappointing to me.
Well, because there was a big controversy with Zarco's... So Yamaha Tech 3 wanted to maintain Zarco's contract.
Right.
Right. And then they found out that they were going to start using KTM engines, right? And so there was a big behind-the-scenes thing there with Zarco. And I'm going to feel real bad for Zarco next year because he's going to lose his ass on that bike.
I know. He's going to lose all the steam he's built up.
You can't feel sorry for him. He had an open invitation to Repsol Honda.
Was it open?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there were some contract things in play there that didn't allow that to happen.
Yeah, why would you ever turn down a Repsol seat?
Because
no matter who
Zarco
you are.
Still Zarco still had like a 1-year contract with either Tech 3 or with or with KTM who they were going to. I'd have to look up the information on it again, but there was a, it was like a mix up, right? Like it was just weird.
Well, yeah. Tech 3 got fed up with Yamaha because they get virtually no support whatsoever.
They don't get shit from them. And the only reason why they're successful is because you took a man like Johann Zarco and you put him on your bike. Right?
Yeah. Meanwhile, Crutchlow is getting near factory support from Honda.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he might as well be on a factory bike, you know, Crutchlow with LCR. Mm-hmm. If Crutchlow could stop throwing it into the weeds, he'd be just fine. But he, you know, it's Crutchlow, right? It's Crashlow, right? He can't stop because he doesn't understand the limit between what his brain wants him to do and the physical capabilities of the bike, right? Like he still tries to exceed that. He's like, I know the bike will go this far. He goes, but I can ride it this far, right? And then sooner or later in the race, the bike goes, no, fuck you, you can't do it like this. Get the fuck off me, right? And just throws him into a gravel trap.
Yeah.
And then he blames it on something completely just.
Right. And then he pulls Ducati drama, right? Like,
oh, it's so good. I love Crutchlow.
I only got 3 pieces of bacon this morning, and my, you know, my team fucked up. You know, well, I'm pretty sure your team did fuck up. So,
right, but I mean, this is kind of the thing. Like, you know, everyone knows that Honda's wet dream is Marquez and Marquez,
right?
But
we all know that's not going to happen, though.
Well, it's not going to happen, but. Honda didn't pull any bullshit like promoting Alex Marquez straight from Moto3 to MotoGP. They didn't do the same thing with like what happened with Jack Miller. And they're not promoting, they're not fast-tracking these people and locking them in, hoping that they're just going to capture the next alien really early.
Honda knows that they don't have to capture anything or anybody because of the performance of the bike. They can have whoever the fuck they want as long as their contract expired, right? Yep. So they don't have to make a big old to-do, and there don't have to be these rumors circulating and flying around MotoGP that so-and-so is interested in Honda, right? Honda doesn't have to participate in that because of the performance of their bike. And they have Marquez who can show you that this bike will do this, right? Like it's back in the heyday, you know, like when Rossi was riding CBR, and then when Rossi was winning championships at Yamaha, Yamaha didn't have to do shit. They just, who do we want? Right?
Yep.
Let's just wait for him, right? And then we'll just go offer him something, right?
Now, where's Mir going? Because Mir's just been bumped up to GP.
Joan Mir, yeah, he's been bumped up to GP, and you guys put me on the spot today because I would have gone back and looked at all this stuff because I just had this lengthy conversation with some other people about where everybody was going. And I thought he was going to...
Mir's going to Suzuki.
That's right.
There you go.
Yeah.
Should have been Iannone and Mir.
You know, I like Rins's consistency. And I think Rins is a more... Rins has a longer future in the sport than Iannone does, and I think that's why they're sticking with Rins. And I think also that...
Right, but 2 years ago, Vinales proved that it's a bike that can win,
yeah,
and no one else has been able to to that except for a few podiums from Iannone. Iannone has been the closest.
But I think part of that problem is that, you know, Suzuki got back into the sport, and what was their the number one concern... with Suzuki was they were lacking the horsepower. They still hadn't done the R&D required to get the type of horsepower gains.
Well, they're still stubbornly sticking to an inline four.
Yes, but I think that just like, right, but this is, I think that's kind of irrelevant because it's like Porsche, right? How long has Porsche been making cars, right? 70 years, 80 years, whatever.
Something like that, right? Yeah.
Okay, so what's the number one flaw with a Porsche? It's rear engine, right? You put all the weight in the back of the car so it doesn't handle on the front end for shit. So, but the Germans have proven...
Well, they're mid-engine now, but...
Well, yeah, but my point of this is that the Germans have proven that they have something that they can... Instead of scrapping the whole thing and starting over, they have made it work. And now, what is a Porsche to you? When I say the word Porsche, do you think of a shitty handling car? No, you think of a very technical, a very advanced, sophisticated vehicle that competes like nobody else. And they are right there with Ferrari and Lamborghini, if not in a lot of cases better, right? So I think Suzuki is I think Suzuki by putting their their efforts into maintaining that in line four, I think that eventually they will succeed with that. I don't think that that's going to be an issue just because they're doing the inline four. Because if you think about how many different engine configurations are in MotoGP, and everybody has found a way to make those work, right? Like Ducati was shit 3 years ago, right? Like 3 or 4 years ago, it was the Honda tractor beam. You put a CBR up against anybody on a straightaway, and the CBR would just rip by everybody like they were holding still. And now it's Ducati. Right, they found a way to make that horsepower, and they found a way to get that, to reduce that wheel spin out of corners, and do those things that they've been lacking over the last couple of years. And I think if they could get the right rider, they would be much more successful.
So you think they're just gonna keep trying a bunch of shit until they just find what sticks to the wall?
Well, I don't think it's about, you know, with engineers, it's not about what sticks to the fucking wall, right?
Well, in terms of the rider, it might be, though. Math.
With riders, yes.
That's what I'm saying.
But everybody does that, right?
Is Suzuki just going to keep firing a rider every single year until they get that guy that just gets the bike instantly?
Well, see, and what I think is, I think that they'll do that on one side of the team. And I think that on the other side of the team, they will keep Rins. So Rins will be like the Rossi of Suzuki, right?
Well, it's kind of like with KTM. Rossi
stuck with Yamaha for so long, right?
Yeah.
And I think that they're trying to do that to Rins. I think they're trying to develop this young talent, Rins, who shows a lot of promise, which he does. He was a great rider in Moto 2.
He was.
And he was very undervalued and underestimated in Moto 2, right? Like you look down, and the next thing you look up, and there's fucking Rins, right? And he's in like second, or he's in the lead, or he's in third, or, you know,
he was amazing in Moto 3. That championship with Alex Marquez came down to the last race, didn't it?
He's sneaky, right? So I think that somebody is paying attention to how sneaky Rins is. And I think that goes.
He is very.
That's a direct compliment to his talent.
He is very underrated that in Moto 3 and in Moto 2, he was.
Always right there.
He was always right there. Always. But, you know, the number of laps that he was leading is very, very, very small. Minimal. But he was always, you know, 2/10 behind the leader. But
look at Rossi.
Every race.
Rossi qualifies 8th place, right? Right? Like,
yeah.
Like, he sucks in free, you know. He can blow you away in free practice, and then you throw him in a qualifying lap, and Rossi looks like a 12-year-old riding them. But, right? Like, he just can't do it. Like, he can't muster it up. You know, that's why Italy, Mugello was so impressive. And I was so glad that the Italian fans got that. I mean, what did he do? He smashed the track record.
Yeah.
He sealed pole position. And I think that was enough for the Italian fans to really kind of, you know, not that they ever lost.
Well, the track record was set by oh gosh, come on, Dovi.
Yeah, Dovi crushed it, and then I believe that Rossi set the fastest pole position lap time. So I think Dovi got the track lap time, and then Rossi got the pole position lap time. We can look that. Maybe we should look up that information because
yeah, and I think Dovi also in qualifying got just the fastest MotoGP top speed ever.
Yes. Well, actually, I think that's what it was. Dovi did the fastest top speed, and Rossi did the fastest lap ever at Mugello.
It might be.
I think that was it.
Because it'd be odd for the fastest lap to not be a qualifying
which,
lap.
And there we go. We can take that and attribute that right back to what we were talking about with Ducati, right? Right? Yeah. I mean, yeah. He's on a Ducati, and he crushed a fucking top speed record.
Yeah.
Anywhere, and Mugello is only the second fastest track on the circuit.
Yes, we might see it again.
So we might see it again.
What? It's not Valencia is the fastest. What is the fastest one?
It's Red Bull Ring, isn't it?
Yeah.
Motegi. The Red Bull Ring, Motegi.
No. A Red Bull Ring is
in Austria. Where is? Oh shit!
It is Austrian, and it's not. It's not Sachsenring in Germany. It's the Austrian GP. I believe it is the Red Bull Ring. It's the track that everyone's like, if the Ducati doesn't win, they just weren't trying.
Right.
That and also Sepang's the one with the three straightaways with the two of them right in a row, yep. Right? Yeah. Yep. That's another one where it's like if Lorenzo or
it's like hairpin straightaway, hairpin straightaways, right? And then
yeah, and they go right around the main grandstands. Yeah. Such a cool design for
that
track.
That's Malaysia.
That you're right. That is Malaysia.
That's Malaysia.
Oh yeah, I did also watch the World Superbike in Thailand, mm-hmm. and I'm actually a little sad that they've included it now because it's a really boring track.
Yeah,
it's the nothing happens.
Well, someone different won. That's enough for World Superbike right. at this point. There's wasn't that. Even a 1-2 Yamaha, right?
Oh no, that was this weekend at last weekend at Brno.
Right.
Yeah, that was a 1-2 Yamaha. And then the other race, well, in the second race, Ray Sykes, and who else? Like four people crashed out of the front pack.
Oh, speaking of crashes, did everybody see Jakob Kornfeld and
yes, we
and,
did.
Yeah. And Moto 3, right?
Like, we were talking, we were wondering, like, because I was like showing that to my employees at work and stuff, and I thought, like, well, half of them had already seen it, and they don't follow motorcycle anything at all. And I was like, is this the moment
insane, right?
where this sport breaks out bigger?
Because it
but
was insane.
It's just clip, whatever. Yeah, but everyone saw yeah. it. The whole world was just like, oh, well,
and,
my God.
And when I first saw it, too.
Austrike.
Because I had to go back and watch the race. So I saw the clip before I saw the before I saw the race. Yeah. And so when he did it, and I saw the replay right in their slow-mo in this, and I was like, this is where he just eats shit into the gravel trap, right? And then just the launch, right? The, just the perfect, right? It was like a Hollywood staged fucking stunt.
I was right? standing was in my kitchen with ridiculous. The laptop on the counter. Just watching Moto 3 going like, yeah, I'm just, you know, burning through these races till I get to GP.
You're just like NASCAR,
and,
right?
And I didn't even have the commentary on. I was actually listening to, I was actually catching up on the last episode of Brodo GP. So I had that going on my headphones while I'm just watching the screen of the race. And I'm just standing there with a piece of bread in my hand, like putting peanut butter on it, making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And I'm only just sort of half paying attention because I'm like, I'm just getting through this Moto 3 race. And then I saw him jump it and I dropped the sandwich I was making.
You're
it
so-
just completely, I was like, oh, he's gonna like die or so. And then he lands it and like
it just keeps going, right?
And like, it was like 1 a.m. because I'd closed down the restaurant and everything, and I was just like, I just gotta catch up on these races, and, you know, the kids are asleep and everything, and I'm just like yelling like, oh my God, and oh my God.
It's so blasphemous for saying that about Moto 3 too. Moto 3 is so much fun to watch.
In general, so I'm with you. Fun. Moto 3
right.
is...
Because you never know who's going to win the race, and that's part of the beauty of it, right? Like, halfway through a GP race, you go, yeah, it's going to be Marquez unless he throws it to the weeds, or it's going to be so-and-so, right? Because you know, most of those teams don't... They don't consider their success their places. They consider their success how far they are behind so-and-so, right? So, right. like, Aprilia never expects to win a race, right? So they try to come within X amount, you know, so many seconds yeah. of this person.
If
and
right.
That's
any,
a successful yeah, day if, at the track for them, right?
If there's yes. two laps to go and they're 3/10 behind eighth place, they're right. like... Ease this, up.
Yeah,
slow down.
Yeah, you know, they're like,
we're getting points.
They're like, this is great, right? But in Moto 3, it's like just this clusterfuck of fun for, you know, every lap of the race, right? I mean, because I mean, think about how did Moto 3 end in Coda, right? Last lap.
Yeah.
Right.
It was,
right.
In general, I'm with you. Moto 3 is super exciting and it's awesome, but like. It, with the exception of Coda, oh, actually, I thought the Moto 2 race was the best one at Coda this year. But in general, Moto 3 hasn't been as good this year. So I'm just not automatically excited.
There's just too many new people in Moto 3. And so the problem with Moto 3 and getting into Moto 3 is that you have to. So like what I do is at the beginning of the season, I go through all the clips and the videos and I look at who's new in Moto 3, right?
Right.
And then I go, all right, cool. So now we know names, right? But now we have to get through a bunch of free practices and we have to get through a few races to understand color schemes and numbers, right? And really figure out, right, like put names to bikes, because every year there are so many newcomers into Moto 3 and typically there's quite a few, you know, half a dozen to, you know, you know, a dozen people that leave Moto 3 and venture off into Moto 2, right? Because Moto 2 will either kill you or you go to GP, right?
Right.
So people will go, yeah, fuck it, I'm done with Moto, and they'll go to World Superbike.
Or you just retire to become a British Superbike champion.
Like they're satisfied with it, right? And so there's this, you know, so in Moto 2, there's two different paths to go, right? They either get out of the sport altogether, or they go to Moto, or they go to Superbike, or whatever. So there's this mass exodus, right?
Yeah, Moto 2 is the meat grinder.
In Moto 2, exactly. And then all these, I mean, they're little kids. I mean, fuck, like, let's admit it.
Well,
like,
they're 16, 17, 18.
Well, 16 is the cutoff, but you remember there are exceptions. Like Fabio Quartararo was, he got permission to race Moto 3 at 15. He was 15 when he started Moto 3.
No, Dorna changed the rules that you have to be over 16 or become the CEV 125 world champion, which, coincidentally, yeah, Quartararo already was.
Yeah, exactly. Which is one of the reasons why they let him in at 15, because that rule didn't exist. It was 16, and then they petitioned Dorna, and Dorna went, sure, whatever. Yeah. They're like, he's the champion. Like, he can handle
Rossi
himself.
Must have taken a shine to him or something.
Well, it's one of those... It's one of those things where, you know...
He's got some invisible pull over there.
Yeah, he does.
It's one of those things where, you know, if you're in Moto 3, you're probably in the top 200 motorcyclists in the world already. And
if not better than that.
And you can win Moto 3 and then just not be shit in Moto 2.
Yeah.
Like, and that's just the way it is.
Well, that's what happened to Quartararo, right? Quartararo went to Moto 2 and just fell on his face. I mean, there to that note as well, Brad Binder went to Moto 2.
Yep.
And didn't do shit and went back to Moto 3. And now he's in Moto 3, even this season.
No, Binder's in Moto 2 on the KTM.
No, you're thinking...
Who am I thinking of then?
You're thinking of Darren Binder.
Yeah, his brother races Moto 3.
Oh, okay. Well, Brad Binder did go down for half a season, though.
Darren Binder had my favorite moment in Moto 3 this year. It was in Argentina, I believe. And someone crosses over him, takes out his front wheel. Darren Binder goes down. It's like lap 17 or something, and he was in like fourth or fifth place. Mm-hmm. So they take him out, and before he even hits the gravel, as he's sliding across the track, gets a middle finger out to the bike that took him out. Unbelievable. And I don't think he even got fined for it, because now there's that special rule that you get a certain X dollar fine for throwing a middle finger on the track, right? Which was I think a rule put in place because of Jack Miller doing it so often.
Jackass, right?
And I was just like, all right, Darren Binder never even needs to win a race. He's automatically my favorite Moto 3 rider now. Just talk about having a fuck you chambered.
And Jack,
you get into a motorcycle accident, and before you're even completely separated from the bike, middle fingers out. What a fucking hero.
Right.
Yeah, those guys exist in bullet time. Like, I don't know how you have those kinds of reactions, but so we were starting to talk about Moto 2 a bit there. What do we think about MV Agusta coming into Moto 2? This is really weird to me, because what really, like, factory teams are there in Moto 2? There aren't. So the whole
idea,
because
everybody's Calix chassis, right?
Exactly. And they just, so, you know, KTM is a factory team.
They're like NASCAR. Moto 2 is like the equivalent to NASCAR, right?
Yes.
Like, you've got the Chevy sticker on your fucking car, and you have a certain variation of a Chevy body, but you're not. You're a piece of plastic with a steel frame that's made by the same person that made the next guy's steel frame, right? Or,
well, here's the thing.
You know,
how valuable
the same motor.
Yeah.
if they ever became really competitive, it's one of those things where, okay, if somebody wins with a Calix frame, which everybody wins, every winner has the Calix frame, right, then you go into MotoGP, and for every MotoGP team that's looking to hire you, that's a known quantity. That's something they know about the kind of bike that you ride, that you've ridden, and they can start.
So
they can work. That's their foundation,
exactly,
that they can start with.
Exactly. So my question to you is: MV Agusta is coming into Moto 2. How are they coming in? Motor or chassis?
I believe it's chassis.
Chassis, because next year everyone's moving to the 765 triple.
MV Agusta doesn't make engines. They use Ducati motors.
MV Agusta makes engines.
Do they?
Yeah, they do, but it's
And most importantly, they make a triple. And a good one.
Who am I thinking of? What's the other Italian company?
That uses Ducati motors? Kajiva used to use Ducati motors.
My point is, though, is that it was.
Oh, I'm thinking of Bimota.
It was a rhetorical question, right? Like, I know MV Agusta is coming in with just chassis, right?
Right.
So they're trying to rival, you know, the Calix chassis, right? And they're trying to, and I don't know what their intention is, you know. Like, I hope they're not going to try and do something weird like KTM in MotoGP, right? Like, KTM has this really weird chassis that they're trying to use.
Yeah, with the trellis frame.
Yeah, and it hasn't worked out for them at all. And that could be a combination of rider, that could be a combination of, you know, lack of R&D, that could be, but I would attribute that chassis to some of that failure. So MV Agusta is going to come in with this new frame to rival the Calix, right? So who's going to ride this fucking thing, first of all? And second of all, how are their chances of going on and moving up into like a MotoGP class with an untested chassis? How is that going to make the GP teams feel to import somebody who is not proven on the industry standard, right? Like, you have Calix, right? And like you said, you know, that's your jump off point, right? To develop a bike around you
let me take that back a little bit, because you know, if somebody comes along and they win on the MV Agusta frame, then that's just going to become the new Calix.
And this is true. So now it raises this question. Do you really think that's going to fucking happen? Because in my opinion, it's just like everybody jumping on the KTM fucking chassis in MotoGP and winning. Nobody's winning. Because it's...
Here's the reason.
It's a matter of trial and error.
Well, right? You can't just bring a new frame in and get a team winning right away.
Exactly.
It's impossible because now you've got to find a Moto2 pit crew that knows how to set up.
Okay, guys.
So those people who are going to be on the Agusta chassis.
The opposite of everything that you're saying. I believe that MV Agusta is going to come in and dominate. And I will tell you why. MV Agusta already has a working race chassis for an inline triple motor, very similar to the new Triumph 675 motor that's going in.
Is
the Calix motor, huh?
Is this test or is this
in a production bike they already have? They've been making
a street bike or a race bike.
MV Agusta has been making race frames for an inline triple for a while. They've been developing this,
but on the street,
But
so that's
my Calix is a frame designed around that Honda 600 motor. What's the Calix frame gonna do with this inline triple? It's gonna be completely different, and it's not gonna suit the Calix.
I think that,
and
the
KTM's gonna have a similar issue as well. MV Agusta is the only team showing up with a brand new frame designed for this engine.
And I believe that they will experience a lot of the same problems. You know, I think people are going to have a problem with chassis flex. And one of the reasons why the Calix chassis works so well is because of its rigidity.
Mm-hmm.
So it allows you to ride a more technical ride, which when you're essentially in a NASCAR class, which Moto2 is,
mm-hmm.
right? That rigid chassis is what it takes out the chassis as a variable that you have to fuck with, right? Because everybody knows, they're like, this is rigid, this works, right? And I don't think that a triple is going to cause any more stress in the Honda engine on the
but
on
the
chassis,
weight distribution's like, different, the sure. height of the engine's different. Sure. It's just you need a whole different custom.
It's one of those things.
I don't think MG Agusta's the answer, though.
It's one of those things, though.
I think
like
they'll
the big
get
issue...
quickly overtaken in a couple years, but I think arriving on the scene with the leg up on the chassis development, which is, as we all know, the main thing in Moto2, I think they're going to be very competitive
away. So, like, the main issue that KTM has
I'm
had...
Moto Domus, man.
Correct. I feel like they'll be further ahead, but they'll be similar to, like, where Suzuki is now, right?
Right.
Like, they'll show up on the scene, and they'll have much, much more... competition in R&D than say like Suzuki when they got right back in the class, but they won't be any better than Suzuki is right now, because how many years of R&D does Suzuki have, right? And they're still working their way up, right? And so I think that MV Agusta is going to be in that place. They will be mildly competitive, but I don't see them winning championships, and I don't see them being top five and
Well, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, KTM has no problem throwing shit tons of money at the sport. But the main problem they've had with the trellis frame is, you know, in theory, the trellis frame is superior.
In theory,
if yes. It's perfectly executed, but it's just impossible.
It's impossible to perfectly execute it.
It's impossible to consistently manufacture, you know, the trellis frame to spec exactly how you want it and make it behave predictably.
Which is what they're figuring out is that it's overly sensitive. Right?
Right.
It's like having a fucking crybaby. Like, you're just on the back of a crybaby, right? And, you know, they're great until something doesn't go their way, and then they're like, yeah, I quit.
Yeah.
Right? Bradley Smith is frustrated with it, right? You know, Paul Spargo, you know, he's frustrated with it.
Well, he's also... Oh, wait. It was Bradley Smith on KTM? I thought he was on the... Oh, no. Mm-hmm. Oh, it was
Aleix Spargo is on Aprilia.
Oh, yep. Yeah.
Aleix is on the Aprilia, and Sam Lowes, but Sam Lowes is done, and the Texas Tornado is now on the Aprilia. Scott Redding is now on the Aprilia.
Wait, Sam Lowes is in
No, Ian Oney and... No. Oh, no, you're talking about this year.
Right now.
And doing nothing.
No, nothing. But he didn't do anything before, so that's not really a... It's not fair to Aprilia, right? They just went, yeah, Redding, whatever, right? Texas Tornado, he just wants to ride, but he's still in the same position that he always has been. And he was great a long time ago, but now, you know, it's like, you know, he's still doing it for the thrill, but we don't expect a lot out of him.
Yeah, Scott Redding,
he's on a not so great team because Aprilia is still, you know, they're still in the wee baby phases of being a competitive team, right?
He's also a chav. Let's not discount that in all of this. So we're in major disagreement about MV Agusta's chances in Moto2, but that's okay. I really do think, because like I said, the biggest single factor in Moto2 besides the rider is the chassis, and I think Kallax's dominance is at the very least going to be thrown up in the air.
Well, the other problem
because
that
it's a new engine, and I think I'm gonna go into a conspiracy theory mode.
Jesus.
That, you know, Honda has stopped making, you know, or putting the 600, or they've stopped using the Honda 600 motor because, you know, race homologation rules, Honda isn't selling that 600 motor anymore. Right, they've dropped the CBR 600 RR. Right, you can still buy like 2016 CBR 600 RRs, but that's it. They don't have 2017 or 18 models, right? So it's fallen out of the category for homologation. But I wouldn't be shocked if, you know, besides the fact that Honda in selling street bikes wants to move in different directions and get into other weirder markets and try to just.
Which they definitely
compete
do.
On what was cool 15 years ago.
By the look of their new CBRs, they definitely want to go somewhere else.
Exactly.
They're just not appealing anymore.
Right. So I wouldn't be, because Honda is so tied to Dorna and MotoGP, right? You know, without Honda, the sport would lose a lot.
Right.
A lot of money. You know, Honda has said, like, if we wanted to, we could just buy everything, but we like competing. So I think with the Moto2 bikes just becoming the Kallax frame, the Honda 600, and that's the formula and nothing else wins, and Moto2 being everyone agrees, like the only one of that sort of approach is boring, right? Like Moto2 is about as thrilling as World Superbike.
I think that Moto2's...
It's better than World Superbike, but you know what I mean? It's the lesser of the three.
Exciting.
And everyone sort of thought, like, there are ways to make the class better. So they're going, all right,
well,
let's use this Triumph motor. Let's just mix it up and throw things up in the air, and we'll get some surprise winners and new manufacturers. And I think it's going to be great. Also, the bikes are going to sound so much better.
I think that, you know, back to that, I think that if MV Agusta is going to be successful, it's going to be a long, hard road, and they're going to have to raise their numbers. Like take Moto3, for example, right? What are all the chassis? Hondas, right? How many Mahindra chassis are in Moto3? Two?
I don't think there are any anymore.
Yeah, they may not be even be Mahindras anymore. Right. There were for a few years. Yeah, there was
like two, right?
Yeah.
So you're playing the odds, right? You're playing the numbers, right? So MV Agusta has to be able to find a way to integrate themselves very quickly so that they can play the numbers, so that they can get a lot of good riders to showcase their chassis and figure out how to ride them and make them function.
Right. Well, what's
which is what's going to be so hard about
the here's the thing. What is the whole point? What are all the different variables that go into a frame in Formula Racing?
Oh, fuck.
It's center of gravity.
Right.
It's going to be... and
rigidity.
It's primarily...
Stiffness in relation to telemetry.
Right.
Right.
And well, those are the two main things. Mm-hmm. And what massively changes when you go from a 600cc inline four to a 765 triple?
Well,
you're going to get torque out the ass.
Like he said, everything changes. Your horsepower drops, your torque increases, right? Now you start dealing with new
anti-wheelie
software that you're going to need.
The horsepower is going to be relatively the same because you've only got three pistons working instead of four, but the torque will increase.
So now you're talking about you've introduced yet another problem that is not going to be solely weighted on the chassis, right? Because now...
Right, but you rely on the chassis to, get the power to the ground. You rely on that chassis flex.
What else do you rely on to get power to the ground that's going to be completely fucked with the raise in torque and the change in motor? Electronics. These bikes do not ride without electronics. They do not ride without fucking anti-wheelie and the different...
Does Moto 2 have anti-wheelie currently?
I don't know if they have anti-wheelie, but the electronics portion of it is still the same. They still have different modes and settings for fuel and corner and straightaway speed. But
if they do have that,
they're going to have to change all that.
It is a spec ECU.
All that's going out the window.
But I don't think they have traction control even. I know they were talking about giving it to them, but I think they decided not to.
No, they still have a level of traction control. It's just like MotoGP, right? Like you can take a MotoGP bike and you can turn up or down the traction control based on your riding style on the bike, right?
Right.
Like Marquez likes to drift it in backwards, right? Like you guarantee you, his traction control's turned way the fuck down, right?
Right.
Rossi's is turned way up, I believe, because he focuses on smoothness, right? He's mm-hmm. very smooth. He rides rails. There's not a lot of times where you will see Rossi with a fuck ton of wheel spin unless his tires are garbage.
Yeah.
Right? And then you take Marquez, and Marquez just backs that bitch in, right? Right? He endos it up to the hairpin, right? Yep. Drops the fucking ass end. Tilts it sideways like a Moto 2 bike and then just, rips back on the throttle if you don't think he's wheel spinning like a motherfucker. Right? Like, he is, right? So he right. has that setting and the part of the team's job is to know what to put him at.
I just thought I remembered that
at the end of last season
or the one before that, they were talking about giving them more or some level of ECU to try to prepare them for moving to MotoGP, because the problem was that these riders were dealing with these pretty raw bikes.
Yes.
And then when they were getting to MotoGP, they didn't know how to deal with all these different settings.
So in true NASCAR fashion, Moto2 is giving them all standardized ECUs.
Right, just like they have in GP and everything.
Yes, but what I heard is with those ECUs, they're giving them more electronic control, right? So the old ECUs were more adjustable, but with less settings. And so these ECUs are less adjustable, but they have more settings and more things that they control and take charge of, right?
Well, there's that, but I think there's also the fact that they're actually now going to go to spec IMUs as well. Which is basically, it's a little board that, your wheel spin sensor, your angle, your tilt sensor, like all the different sensors go into that first. And then the IMU cleans that up and gives like actual data to the ECU.
Well, I think that was part of their plan with this anyway. And I don't know, and I haven't heard anything on it, but it would be my logic and common sense would tell you that a cleaner data stream to the pit crews and the teams is super advantageous for future R&D of the bikes and also
was also the fact that all the MotoGP teams are effectively cheating right now, because what they're doing is they all have, instead of having their own custom ECUs that they're using to get squeeze everything out of the bikes, they've all been making these super sophisticated IMUs, and they're just fudging the data that goes into the ECU to make it behave the way their old ECUs did.
Legal's legal.
If you're not cheating, you're not trying. I love it. Yeah, you know Honda and Ducati at the forefront.
Listen, you're talking to the wrong person. I ride a 636.
Right? Yeah.
The cheater bike, right?
So good. So good. All right. Let's see. So besides the tragedy of Iannone going to Aprilia, putting up no results, and then eventually just losing a ride forever. That's what's going to happen.
I know.
This is the end of Iannone.
And I'm a fan of the maniac, and I hate when I see people make potentially career-ending moves. Right, because you know this is
a career-ending move.
I don't think it was his decision to make. I think it was Suzuki shitting the bed.
Yeah,
well, Suzuki's good at that, but
yeah, this is the end of Iannone. He will never be able to post anything on that Aprilia. This isn't a situation where Vinales can put out some good stuff.
Well, you know, I don't think Iannone should
on the Suzuki, the place, and then
that wasn't his decision either.
Yeah, like Iannone's
getting pushed around, so they've been trying to push him out, right? Because
it's all right.
Who did they replace him with in Ducati?
It's fine.
Mir. Lorenzo. Lorenzo.
Right? Do you think that was Iannone's decision? Fuck no.
Nope.
Right? And then he goes to Suzuki, right? Now Suzuki's pushing him out because Suzuki.
Now he's getting pushed out by a Moto2 rookie. Like, that's embarrassing.
It's okay. He'll just go to World... He'll just replace Melandri and go win World Superbike.
I hope so.
Rung further down he can go to.
I hope this isn't the end of the maniac.
I think it is, though, and that's super sad for me.
His ego can't take it.
But when you also think about how many riders...
He'll just disappear in a puff of smoke. His mind won't be able to take it, and it'll overtake his physical form, and he'll have to just sublimate into something else, and I don't know. All of a sudden, like, you know, everyone within a 20-mile radius will just get a little bit hornier.
Maybe they'll just make him one of the lead characters on an Italian soap opera or on a Spanish soap opera, right?
That would be a great move.
That would be a perfect move for him, right? Big contract, right? All the women, right? Right?
Yeah. He could be just becoming a porn star.
I don't want to see the maniac as a porn star, dude. I don't want to see the maniac cum shots, right? Like, that would be the next thing to just be broadcast everywhere. And then,
all right. Besides that, I don't really have any more interesting silly season news because Mir, we have no idea what's going to happen. That's just a weird shot in the dark.
We just don't know how he's going to perform, really,
the,
I mean, because isn't his contract sealed? Isn't he signed, sealed, delivered?
He's signed, sealed, delivered, and just as Zarco is on KTM, which I think might be another career-ending move.
Yeah, I have to agree with that, too, which I'm going to be really sad because
it's a dangerous move when you're 27 and then you pick... an unknown factory.
All
the only person who has made a smart move this season was Rossi to re-sign through 2019. How's that? He's the only one.
No, Lorenzo going to Repsol was a smart move for him. It may not be a smart move for Repsol, but it's a smart move for Lorenzo. I pointed out, because he didn't post any results on that Ducati for 18 months.
Right.
He's got an argument that he can go to Repsol and do nothing for a year and a half and don't worry, guys, it's coming.
And my question is, right, is so Lorenzo has, you know, very, you know, he hasn't done it in an exciting way, but he's brought his...
Does he ever won in an exciting way?
No, well, you know, he's just a machine, right?
So only like, in we, the only know, in this different. Last race, the novelty of him being able to do this thing we thought he couldn't do anymore.
Well, exactly. And he was the one that told everybody it, that he would do it. That did make it
fun for
me. He told everybody that he would do it, right? We had no idea it would take a year and a half, right? Like, nobody knew. But he told everybody and promised everybody that he would do it, right? So now he's delivered. So my question is what's with the... Like, what's with the back and forth shit? Why doesn't Ducati just sign Lorenzo on for another 2 years, keep developing the bike? Maybe by his fourth year in Ducati, he could win a championship. And then they have two monsters, right?
You
have
because Davizio, his results so, were have, already so you know, Lorenzo. Bad, they had been working on other things. They already had Petrucci or potentially Miller or someone else because they were just like, we are abandoning ship.
The issue is that everyone is trying to snag the next alien. And because of that, everyone's trying to get ahead of everybody else. And everybody is jumping the gun.
It's lack of commitment and it has turned MotoGP into, whereas this has been exciting and fun and there's always stuff to talk about with MotoGP, and these seasons are very rare. Usually it's, you know, very kind of standardized moves or none at all, right? So as exciting as it's been great, and it's been good to keep up on, and I'm sure that they've gotten a bigger fan draw from it, but Jesus Christ, dude, somebody just fucking commit to a rider for a while, right? Like, just do it and develop somebody, which is why I'm kind of,
develop the bike,
which is why,
and then when you've got the bike, go after the right rider,
which is why, well, I don't even think that. I think that you develop the bike to the rider. So what you have to do is you have to commit to the rider. Like Repsol has gone from being a very technical bike to being a very bull ridden bike. Why? Because Marc Marquez, they've developed it to him. They've signed him long term. They know they're going to keep him long term, right? And you need to do, everybody needs to try that out for 4 or 5 years, right? The sport's been around long enough. You know that 5 years is a drop in a bucket, right? Which is why I'm excited that Rins is sticking with Suzuki, because I feel like Suzuki is going to actually make a long term commitment to Rins and develop the bike for Rins and his riding style, because he has had proven consistency in Moto 2, where he hasn't been a huge winner, but he's always been in the top in the championship points, right? And he's always been a high placing rider, and they see the consistency in him. And I feel like they have a good feeling that they could make him and make the bike and Suzuki as a manufacturer a winning manufacturer in MotoGP. And that's why I think that it's a very solid move to keep Rins, even though we're all personally a big fan of, you know, Ian Oney.
That's actually a really good point, because when you look at what, you know, when you look at what Honda's doing, you know, Honda has always jumped from, has always been able to attract the top talent and all these
right
eccentric riders. You know, they've gone through Rossi and Dovizioso and Marquez and Pedrosa and Casey Stoner. And they've kind of, and all of those riders have all evolved from, when you think about it, they've come through the two-stroke era, the early four-stroke era, and they've all evolved around that style of bike.
Right. Remember, Rossi was on a 500cc.
Right. And now you've got Moto 3 and Moto 2, which are overall very predictable and very, and because all the bikes are all kind of the same across the whole class, they all, when you're riding the exact same bike as everybody else,
strategy, team, and rider. That's it. Right. That's all it comes down to. Bikes have nothing to do with
the Moto 3. So if the Suzuki becomes an extension into the next class of the same strategy, now you've just massively opened up your pool of riders, because it's all the same strategy.
And what is Suzuki? Suzuki is a very, is a very plain Jane technical bike for all intents and purposes, right?
Right.
It is the sister of the Yamaha as far as race teams go. And the Honda team has developed into a very, very toned down bull of a Ducati, right? Mm-hmm. So, and Rins comes from a very technical class, right? I mean, Rins came from NASCAR, basically, right?
Yeah. So, and let's not forget, he just destroyed in Moto 3. Did he win? He came close to winning, right? Like, he came like second. It was one of those super close Moto 3 championships.
2 years in a row. I think he came second in Moto 3, and he came second twice against.
But his consistency in Moto 2 Zarco? Was.
That sounds right.
Yeah, because Zarco was the double world champion in two, because he was one of the few riders that actually stuck around for two seasons in Moto 2. Usually they do something. Usually they go somewhere right there.
Well, unless you're Tom Luthi, who hangs around there for almost a decade. Yeah,
but I mean, once a Moto 2 rider wins a championship, 9 times out of 10 they move on.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, someone picks him up. But for some reason, no one was pulling for Moto 2 that year. They were pulling for Moto 3. And
well, it's because they were promoting Jack Miller and saying, Moto 2's dead. We're just pulling straight from Moto 3. Well,
Zarco made the decision himself to stay in Moto 2.
Well, yeah, because there was no seats open for him.
Well,
wasn't a seat he liked.
Yeah, exactly. And he wanted to stay in Moto 2 and smash some heads because he knew he could do it again, right? Because it's Zarco, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, these people all have the personality to just go, I fucked you up once, I'll just do it again, right? Before they move on. So, and that season ended up paying off for him because his transition into MotoGP was seamless, right? And especially the team he picked. And I think that he saw the history with Cal Crutchlow in Tech 3 and Bradley Smith in Tech 3 and right the riders that had been through Tech 3 and that had made those bikes work. And then he understood that Tech 3 was getting even more technology from, Yamaha, even though they're pretty much being starved compared to, like we were talking about earlier, like LCR Honda or something.
Right.
But they're still getting stuff.
Yeah, they don't get nothing. But, I mean, yeah, in terms of other teams, they're hung out to dry.
Yeah, they are. But they have a very determined team.
Yep.
Right? Which more than makes up for it.
Yeah, it's a lot better to go to Tech 3 than it is like...
Yeah, because you have a bunch of well-put-together
Estrella
guys.
Galicia.
Right? Yeah, Estrella Galicia, Jesus Christ. Oh, Moto 2, I mean, they're great, but in GP, right? Like
was Mark VDS. But Mark VDS isn't going to be a team next year, right? Didn't Mark VDS throw in the towel?
Oh, in GP. He's going to stay in 2 is what I heard. He's going to stay
in 2. And probably 3, because it's traditionally actually been a fairly good Moto 3 team.
It's been a great Moto 2 team, too, because remember, Morbidelli came from...
That's right, Mark Morbidelli, VDS. And they've had...
Right, Jack Miller came from...
Yep,
from
Mark VDS.
Yep, from Mark VDS, right? And I think... I shouldn't say his name, because then it tarnishes... Tito Rabat come from Mark VDS?
Yeah.
We won't talk about him. And actually, he's been doing much better this year than he has in many, many seasons.
He couldn't have done any worse.
Well, I mean, he could have.
Well, yeah, he could have like had like,
but he's
been... Lorenzo's season last year, I guess.
Right. But he is doing. I'm impressed with Tito Rabat for what he's given and what he is, and I think what his motivations are. I think he's doing
what
well.
He is the goofiest looking dude on the grid.
He's the Bugs Bunny of MotoGP, man. That guy, man. I don't know how anybody could get any uglier, but whatever. He's not there for looks. He puts on a helmet. Nobody knows what he looks like, right?
There you go.
And he's like the size of Ben's bees, right? He's like it's just like all elbows and knees and shit when he rides.
All right. So let's see. We're at a pretty good amount of time here. Anything else to say before we wrap this up? No, I think we're good. All right. So this is MotoGP signing out for Swiggy and Maddie. And remember, you can email us at nocomotopodcast@gmail.com. Please leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes or 1-stars. I don't give a shit. Just some sort of review. And with that, remember to stay safe and stay tuned. We're going to do the outro.
And I don't want to die. Just want to ride on my motorcycle. Mm-hmm, cold.
That's a wrap.